It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an engineer from Milwaukee is part of the team operating the cameras on the Mars Perseverance rover. We'll talk to him about his career and what it takes to snap pictures on another planet. First, companies and governments are increasingly using automation and artificial intelligence to cut costs, transform workplaces, and in many cases, to eliminate jobs. Our next guest says the technology has a lot of potential to make our lives better, but it all depends on the motivations of the humans in charge. And he says the key to living in a world built around machines is to lean into what makes us human. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think automation has, ultimately will, change our lives overall for the better? Do you think it's ultimately having a negative impact? Do you work in a job where you're worried about automation changing what you do, eliminating the job that you have? Has it already happened to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin Roos is a technology columnist for the New York Times and host of the podcast Rabbit Hole. He writes and speaks regularly about topics including automation and AI, social media, disinformation, and cybersecurity. His new book is called Future Proof: 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
When I think automation, what pops into my head, Kevin, is you have people, they do a physical job, and then you bring in a machine and it replaces that work. That's part of the story, but as you write in your book, that's only a small part. Can you give us a sense of the scope of automation and artificial intelligence, AI, in the world out there right now?
Yeah, you're right. For a long time, when we heard the word automation or robot, we thought about a machine in a factory, car factory maybe, or some other piece of big machinery that was doing automated work. But now when we say robot or automation, what we really mean is software most of the time. It's programs that are being built and implemented inside big companies to do the kinds of work that white collar workers have been doing. So things like accounting, things like law, medicine, journalism, these industries that have been sort of thought of as immune from automation are now becoming targets of it thanks to artificial intelligence and other advances.
And a scary thing is if we look at our own jobs and think, oh, there's no way anything other than a human could do this, there's a significant chance anyway that we're wrong. How do we evaluate that kind of thing?
Absolutely. I mean, there have been some studies recently that have found that the most vulnerable people to AI and automation are actually not manufacturing workers. They're not truck drivers. They're not retail workers. They're people in sort of analytic technical jobs in middle management sometimes, people who are higher paid, people who have college degrees and specialized training. There's not a real protection for those people anymore because AI is doing cognitive work in addition to manual work.
Often the job that disappears because of automation, you write, isn't because a company said, we're going to replace those jobs with automation. You give the example of Kodak, the photo company. They weren't put out of jobs directly by photo-taking robots or by their own bosses. Can you tell that story and how it's an example of how automation can affect us unexpectedly?
Yeah, well, I think we think of automation in that traditional way. You know, you come into work one day and your boss says, I'm sorry, we've just got this robot. It does what you used to do, so we won't be needing your services. But more often, it's that underlying behaviors change or that small companies replace big companies in doing the same work. So what happened with Kodak wasn't that they all got automated out of their jobs. They didn't build robots that took everyone's photos for them and processed them. Instead, what happened was that the behavior changed. We started carrying smartphones that had cameras on them. We started sharing images on social media instead of developing them at the drugstore. And so when that underlying behavior changed because of automation, you no longer needed film canisters. You no longer needed SLR cameras to take good pictures. And so as a result, Kodak went on a downward spiral. But it wasn't in the way that we traditionally think of it because those jobs were automated.
In a couple minutes, we're going to get into some of the rules you share for how to survive and hopefully thrive in this world of automation. First, I want to ask you about the big picture here. There are people who say, hey, this automation is going to be a net gain across the board, free us up from drudgery, our lives are going to be better. There are people who fear it. You know, oh, the Terminator and the Matrix, those look pretty good compared to what's really going to happen. Where do you fall on that Matrix to a utopia continuum?
Well, I call myself a sub-optimist because I am largely optimistic about the technology itself. I think AI and automation could create amazing new jobs. They could dramatically improve people's lives. We could discover cures for rare diseases. We could help fix the climate. We could work less because the robots are doing more of what we used to do. But it really matters how we implement this stuff. If we implement AI and automation, if companies use it to free up workers from boring and dangerous tasks, if they're spreading the gains from automation around to workers, then we could be in a really good place. But what we're seeing right now, and the reason I'm not fully an optimist, is that a lot of companies are not doing that. They're using AI and automation to actually make their workers' jobs more robotic and more mundane and more predictable, sort of turning them into human extensions of the robots. And you see that at places like Amazon warehouses, where people just stand in one place all day and pick things brought to them by robots and put them into boxes. But you also see that at white collar workplaces now, where humans are essentially becoming extensions of the software.
We're talking to Kevin Roos, technology columnist at the New York Times. His new book is called Future Proof: 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Are you optimistic or pessimistic or a little of both about this changing world of automation, not just of physical work, but a lot of the mental work out there too? 800-642-1234. Kevin, the heart of your book is advice for people, also for businesses, I think, and policymakers of how to deal with this world. Let's start with individual people. Your rule one is be surprising, social, and scarce. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, this rule really came as a result of going to AI experts, people who work in this field, and asking them, what are the things that humans can do that will be very hard to automate? Sort of where are the machines' weak points, and how do we become stronger in those areas? And so what they told me was that 3 types of work, surprising, social, and scarce, are going to be very difficult for computers to do as well as humans. Surprising work would be things that involve lots of changes and shifting variables and uncertain rules. Things like, you know, being a kindergarten teacher would be a very hard job to automate because it's all surprises. It's all chaos. Social jobs are jobs that involve making people feel things. Machines are very good at making things more efficient, at doing processes better than humans can, but they're not good at sort of inspiring us or challenging us or doing the kinds of work that our therapists and nurses and bartenders and baristas and flight attendants do. Those jobs are social, and so they're harder to automate. And then scarce work would be work that involves sort of rare skills or sort of high stakes circumstances, which is why when we call 911, for example, we get a human, not an answering machine. We have the technology to automate that job, but we've sort of decided that it's too important to automate. So those are the 3 types of work I think we should be doing more of, because that's going to be the stuff that is hardest to automate.
Well, Brandy on Facebook writes that she never liked having to talk to people to book flights or do taxes, a couple jobs that have been automated. But she says she loves that this stuff is automated. But when she needs customer service assistance, she much prefers a human being. So there's a place where the human touch, and this is a theme in your book a lot, the human touch really does make a difference. Is that being reflected in the job world?
It is. Yeah, I think that customer service is one of these things that was automated a long time ago. I mean, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we had automated phone trees, but people didn't really like them. They weren't very good. And so me, you know, for just speaking for myself, when I get an automated phone tree, I'm pressing 0. I want to talk to the human as quickly as I can because they're going to be better at solving my problem than a machine is. So I think that's an instance in which jobs are actually being de-automated in customer service. We're moving from machines back to humans because the humans turn out to be way better at that job.
Yeah, so a machine can be really good at doing the same task, making market trades, it turns out, or reading legal documents was one like where you can do the same thing again and again. The machine seems to have the advantage. When you have to expect the unexpected, I guess that's part of our human advantage and adapt to the unique state of each condition.
Exactly. So for routine customer service interactions, you know, paying your phone bill, you know, placing some order for something, I mean, that's something that can be automated and those jobs have been automated. But if you get into the sort of harder situations, the more nuanced situations, you know, you have a complicated insurance issue that you want to explain to someone, or you have an Airbnb problem and you need to talk to a human about it. I mean, those are instances in which a machine is not going to cut it. And so that's where the value for humans is in doing the kind of work that is less routine and more surprising and human.
Kevin Roos is with us talking about his new book. It's called Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you worry in some ways about a future increasingly reliant on technology? Is there an experience you have when shopping or working where you would rather have a machine do the work versus where you'd rather have a human do the work? Has your job been affected for better or worse by automation of some sort? Is it still your job after that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Kevin Roos, technology columnist for the New York Times, author of the new book, Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. How has your own workplace been changed by new machinery that you could see, new software that you can't, but you could see the work it's doing, or maybe it's so far behind the scenes you don't even know it? Has your job changed? Has your job turned into something new? Has it gone away? And if you are a customer, where do you prefer to deal with an automated system? Where do you want a human? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. We got an email from Cassandra, Kevin, who says, is the pandemic increasing automation, in part so people are less exposed to the illness? How has the pandemic changed things, Kevin, when it comes to automation?
Absolutely. I think this is the big untold story of 2020 was the unprecedented acceleration of automation and AI. Basically, we went forward a decade in a year, and one of the fastest transformations has been in AI. Companies are automating jobs like crazy, replacing all kinds of workers. And it's some of it is just because there's been so much demand for certain things, like, you know, at Amazon warehouses. But there's also this kind of political cover that the pandemic provided to executives. I spoke to a number of executives and automation consultants who said, you know, before the pandemic, we were scared to automate jobs because we thought it might freak out our workers, or we might hear from the mayor of our town. We didn't want to be characterized as job killers. But during the pandemic, with so many businesses struggling, they've really kind of gotten a pass on that. So it's a safe time for them to automate. And so they've been doing a ton more of it. And actually, McKinsey, the consulting firm, just increased its estimate of how many workers will be displaced by automation. Before the pandemic, they had it at something like 37 million jobs between now and 2030 would be automated. And now that's gone up to 45 million.
And on the negative positive scale here, defenders of automation, you write to look back at past industrial revolutions and whatnot and say, yeah, some jobs go away, but the increased productivity creates new jobs, new opportunities, things work out. Is that necessarily going to happen this time, Kevin?
Well, I think they're being a little bit glib about that. If you actually go back, and I did go back and read some of the accounts of what it was like to live through the Industrial Revolution and the first wave of factory automation in the 20th century, I mean, these were not all happy campers. Not everything worked out for people as well as I think the pro-automation optimists like to say it did. But there's also some evidence that this time is different, not just because the sort of pace of technology has accelerated, but because the kind of technology we're getting is different. there's a couple economists who coined this term called so-so automation, which is basically automation that is just barely good enough to replace a human, but not so good that it generates all kinds of new opportunities for humans. So this would be your customer service automation line or the self-checkout machine at the grocery store. You know, that doesn't make your groceries cheaper. It doesn't make it, you know, 10 times more efficient to shop. All it does is kind of remove a few humans from the store's payroll and puts the labor onto customers instead. So that's an example of sort of so-so automation. And that's the kind that's really dangerous because we're getting the downsides of automation, the lost jobs and opportunities for people, but we're not getting what we've gotten in the past, which is the upside, which is all these new dynamic industries that are created because of new technology.
Getting back to some of the advice you offer, one is something kind of outside the workplace in a lot of ways, being careful the way we let automatic processes dictate our lives, guide our habits, whether that's a music recommendation or a video streaming recommendation or whatever. You examined your own life in this way and tried to figure out how, in effect, the robots were running your life. What did you find out?
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of us have let robots run our lives to a certain extent. I mean, just today, I woke up, I checked Twitter and Facebook, I looked at my Gmail inbox, I asked my, my smart assistant what the weather was going to be. I listened to some music that was recommended to me by Spotify. Like, that's at least five or six different AIs that I interacted with before breakfast. And that's happening to all of us. We are turning over our choices to the algorithms and the AIs that run these giant tech platforms that we use every day. And I think the danger of that is that our phones and our devices are becoming our bosses, and they're making us behave more like robots and less like humans. So they're structuring our choices. They're sort of making us more homogenous and predictable. We need to be human in order to survive this AI revolution. And in order to do that, we need to get off our phones, get away from our screens, and start sort of reclaiming our own choices, because that's a sort of first step on the road to becoming more human.
Talking to Kevin Roos about his new book, Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like with your experiences on the job in the working world as a customer. How has automation, if it has at all, changed your job at 800-642-1234? Do you think that the job you do is robot proof? You couldn't be replaced by technology. Tell us why. 800-642-1234. Kevin, your advice isn't just on the individual scale. You have thoughts on how, on a societal level, and this could be nationwide or even in a local community, we can make sure that people displaced by these kind of technologies aren't just lost. They aren't just in a hopeless situation. What kind of things do you think we need to do?
Well, on the federal level, I think there are a lot of things we could learn from how other countries have dealt with this. You know, we've had automation-related job losses for hundreds of years. And in places like Sweden and Japan, they have these kind of job councils that sort of catch people when they are displaced by automation, when their job is automated. They kind of help people get back on their feet, retrain them to do something else, and sort of support them while they make the transition from the old jobs to the new jobs. But we don't really have anything like that here in the States. And I think it's time that we start thinking about something that could do that, whether it's a more universal basic income system or whether it's kind of a Sweden and Japan style job council. I think that's a big part of it. But I think also on the local level, we can be doing more to invest in each other. We can be helping each other sort of build new skills that are more future-proof, that are sort of harder to automate. We can be retraining people in industries where jobs are very quickly disappearing. And we can have a more honest conversation about this that is, you know, not in denial that there are actually some jobs that will be displaced by this technology, but that, you know, if we see it coming and we can sort of orient ourselves toward the future, we can actually make it so that people aren't being sort of, they're not slipping through the cracks of this technological transformation, that they're actually benefiting from it.
Do you see that kind of thing happening in local communities, especially here in the United States?
I don't really. And I'm open to hearing about counterexamples where this is happening. But I grew up in northeastern Ohio and sort of a post-industrial place. And it was really hard hit by globalization and free trade and automation. And there hasn't really been a lot of bounce back from that. And so I think it's going to take some real effort, some real, spending, some real federal involvement, some real dedication to bringing back these communities that are being torn apart by automation.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for the discussion. As usual, we seem to be dancing around the elephant in the room in these discussions about automation. Like technology just fell out of the sky, or these things are inevitable because the market is just imposing these conditions on us. No, these things were brought about intentionally over a long period of time. I mean, yeah, automation is efficient. It saves businessmen money and drives workers out of jobs, but it didn't get that way because of the market. It was a long period of prolonged and intensive funding and development through the state sector, market distortion. So the purpose of it has to do with straight power interests of the owning class. The point is to create de-skill workers and increase managerial control. I mean, why can't we admit this about our rotten economic system? These things,
Marcus. Thanks a lot for the call. Lots to work with there, Kevin. In your book, you say, yes, these are definitely the result of conscious decisions. But Marcus saying the goal is to create de-skilled workers. What do you think of that in just a minute or so before we take a news break?
Yeah, I think there's a lot there. And I think there's a lot of truth there. We are making these decisions. These robots are not taking jobs on their own. And I think we have to recognize that workers have to sort of be part of this process. One of the things that has historically made automation go better in places like the auto industry is because the workers were unionized and they got a seat at the table while the executives were working out how they were going to implement factory robots. So I think we need some sort of worker solidarity around this stuff, because otherwise, you're right, it's just going to redistribute money and power to the people at the top.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Kevin Roos, author of the new book, Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a thought, a question, maybe an experience with a job being automated fully or partially? That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Kevin Roos, technology columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. What industries do you think are safe from automation? What's unique about what a human can do compared to a robot or an algorithm? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Jackie is with us in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Kevin. I had to call in because this is such an interesting show to me. I don't use any cell phones. I never have. And you just slowly watch people get more and more disconnected. They don't notice what's around them. They don't, it's hard to have a conversation or even talk to them. And way back, I know people that started coaching robotics. And I thought, why is that coming up? Are they going to be replacing people and jobs? And here we are. That's what's happening. So, there's some really good things about AI and all that, but you're giving up so much, like the humanness is gone. Kevin was saying, you call the customer service and the option that the automated service doesn't give it to you. So then what? Then you're standing online for an hour and you never get an answer. So I was in customer service for many, many years, and I love talking to people. So I don't know. It just seems like it's going to change the world so much that it's going to take a good part away from it.
And Jackie, I'm glad you called to talk to us. Kevin, her story about watching people with their cell phones. You had kind of a before and after moment with that. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, well, I did a 30-day phone detox last year. I actually had a phone coach who sort of guided me through a process where the goal was not to sort of throw away my phone altogether. I don't think that for most people that's realistic. The goal was to just examine my own phone use. And so I found myself horrified by the trouble that I had kind of being alone with my thoughts. Every spare moment I was filling with my phone every day. And I think for a lot of us, it's become very hard to just be idle and think and imagine and create. And those are the deeply human skills that are going to help us survive in the age of automation. So I think that's worrisome for a lot of us.
Jackie, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Michael now in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hello, yes. I'd like to offer agreement with much of what your author has said. I think that large part, automation does help. I actually work in the field of automation. I automate warehouses. But in the regards to distributing that wealth that's created, I think more should be done that way.
Michael, we lost you. Michael, thanks a lot for calling in. So he says, Michael says he likes the work he does automating warehouses, but how the wealth is distributed. And that's, you know, that idea, Kevin, that, okay, we're more productive. We have more time on our hands. Everybody's going to benefit. Sounds like Michael says he'd like to see that benefit people a little more evenly.
Absolutely. I mean, the automation is not evil. It is, in fact, it can help us quite a bit, but it really, really matters how we do it. If it's just used to make the people at the top richer while exploiting the people at the bottom, that's not going to be good. I mean, we've seen that happen before and it doesn't end well. But if, you know, it results in us all working 3-day weeks and making more money and having more control over our lives, more time to spend with our families, I mean, this could be a wonderful thing.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Carl now in West Allis. Carl, hi.
Hi. Turning my radio on maybe 10 minutes ago, so the caller at the time was mentioned about unions and potential there, and I'm over 80 now, retired, but I go back into 1960s when a brother-in-law of mine in Milwaukee, a union person, was elected into the United Community Services. There was a liaison between the union because of him and United Community Services. So he invited me to meetings. I was in the union, AFL, the CIO at the time, and the union, and then the Teamsters. But anyway, the discussion, both in Milwaukee and in New York City, I went with him a couple times, and the union was discussing the future. This is back in the 1960s, and maybe it's no big secret, but they were thinking ahead of the future for mainly labor people, and that they had ideas like shorter work hours, and emphasizing the quality of their life that they can pursue. Their own interest, cultural or otherwise.
Carl, thanks a lot. And there it is again. Will automation, Kevin, free us up to work fewer hours, as Carl said, the work-life balance? And yet, it seems like these days there are a lot of people who are working 60, 80 hours, and that's valued, the hustle life and things like that. How did we go in exactly the opposite direction of what Carl was talking about? Kevin? Not hearing Kevin Roos. Did we lose him? You could join in at 800-642-1234. In the meantime, that's 800-642-1234. Talking to Kevin Roos about his book, Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. Do we have you on the line, Kevin? Not sure what's going on there. You, in the meantime, can comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Interested, even if we don't get Kevin back, in hearing your stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page about how automation has affected your life. 800-642-1234 is the number. There you are, Kevin. Hey. Yeah, so the question of, okay, there were hopes from the labor movement that automation would lead to shorter hours, better lives, but we've ended up with people working a lot more hours. How did we go that way?
Well, I think it comes down to the choices that the people who have run big companies have made. I mean, they could be spreading the gains from this stuff around. Instead, they're using AI and automation to increase the pace of work, to require more of people, to surveil them. I mean, if you go into a warehouse today, you'll see that there are cameras everywhere because AI and other systems are being used to track people's productivity down to the millisecond. And I think that's really a dangerous trend. We should be using technology to make people's lives better and take away their drudgery and not create more of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. So if somebody's out there listening and thinking, yeah, I'm a little worried about my job the potential for it to be replaced or disrupted in one way or another, what are some steps, what kind of checklist can we do to try to start future-proofing our lives?
Well, I have 9 rules in the book, and they range from very sort of personal, close to home things about how you're using your phone and your devices to big picture things about what we need to think about at a federal and community level. But I would say that it starts with figuring out who you are and what you value and what your uniquely human skills are. What can you do that can't be replaced by a machine? And then try to find ways to make your work as close to that as possible.
And then throwing back to a point that our caller Marcus made earlier, and you hit pretty hard in your book, these changes aren't natural or inevitable or just a process divorced from human intention. Can you talk about our power to make decisions about how we do and don't use different forms of automation?
Yeah, absolutely. I live out in the Bay Area where people tend to talk about technology as this kind of like natural force, like it's a hurricane or something and it's just coming toward us and all we can do is either sort of, duck and cover or find high ground. But we make choices about this stuff. We, collectively decide how new technology is used and what rules are placed around it. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to really pay attention to what's going on in the economy right now and to fight for forms of AI and automation that make people's lives better and that treat people more fairly and to resist forms of automation and AI that don't.
We'll leave it there. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kevin Roos, technology columnist at the New York Times, host of the podcast Rabbit Hole. He writes and speaks a lot about topics including automation and AI, social media, disinformation, and more. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Future Proof, 9 Rules for Humans in the Age of Automation. Still time to share your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsinite who's helping operate the cameras on the Perseverance rover currently exploring the surface of Mars. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, find out about the latest efforts to bring new teachers into the profession and to bring in people from a wide variety of backgrounds. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, NASA's Perseverance rover landed on Mars just over a month ago, and it's already given us some of the clearest pictures we have of the red planet. Those pictures, aside from being cool, will help scientists decide where to take a closer look and get samples as they search for evidence of ancient life. And one of the people responsible for getting those images and making sure they get back here to Earth hails from Wisconsin. Darian Dixon is the MastCam-Z data management lead on the Perseverance mission. He's a Milwaukee native and a graduate of Riverside High and UW-Milwaukee. Darian, thanks a lot for joining us today. Darian, are you there? We'll get to Darian Dixon in just a moment. Hearing him, let's see. Oop, Darian, there you are. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. That was us. So can you tell us a little bit about the MastCam and what it does?
Yeah. So the MastCam instrument are 2 stereoscopic cameras. So they sit kind of in left and right positions like eyes on the top of the mast of the rover. We like to call them the eyes of the rover. If you were to look at the mask, look at the head, they literally look like, you know, the little eyes up there. And these cameras are able to pan around on Mars and zoom in and out and take really high resolution imagery of the surface. And we use these on a pretty extensive basis to bring down some of the really nice, really high quality, cool color imagery that you see of Mars.
Can you talk about the work that had to happen before the rover was even launched? What all went into getting this mast cam ready?
So much work, so much design work. I think the design process has been years and years and years in the making of really narrowing down all the technical specifications of the cameras. There's actually a filter set, a set of multispectral filters that allow us to image in different spectrums of light besides just the visible spectrum. And there was a lot of iteration back and forth on choosing those filters and really pinning down the best filter set that would allow us to detect some of the things, detect some of the chemical properties we want to detect on Mars. And then so much testing. There was a process called calibration that happened at my company a few years back, where we literally spent hours and hours and hours in the clean room, in the lab, taking thousands and thousands of images to figure out how every single pixel on the camera performed, because we wanted to know every little bit about how it would work on Mars to help us use it. So it's been years of work, years of painstaking work and design and testing to get it ready before it ever went up to Mars.
Okay, so I'm sure you've been asked this before, Darian, but you've put all this work into this project, and then it's landing day. The rover's going to land on Mars or not. All of your work leading up to this hinges on this short period of time and a successful landing. What's going through your mind as you're watching?
Oh, my God. That day was an emotional roller coaster. My wife has pictures and videos of me sitting on the couch just watching the coverage on the TV. And I couldn't take my hands, like, off my face. I just hands on my face, like, eyes wide, tapping my foot, pacing. I ate all the food in the house out of stress. It was just, it was an unbelievable feeling, you know. So many years went into this, and we're so eager to hit the ground and get going. But to know that in that very moment, you know, this is the most dangerous part of the whole mission. And there is a very real non-zero chance that all that work could literally go up in smoke. So I was nervous. I was stressed. And
let's flip to the after. Now it lands and you get the first image. You get confirmation that not only is the project on the ground, it is taking images and sending them back. What did that feel like when you got that first indication?
Screaming. Never in my life have I ever just screamed so uncontrollably. I was yelling, jumping for joy. It was beautiful. You know, I had to fight back tears and everything. And it was so unbelievable to think that we had landed on Mars. We had done that feat, and, you know, NASA's done that before, but to be a part of it, this was my first time being a part of a mission that was actually landing. It was indescribable. And I was so happy, and I'm still so happy. I feel like I'm still riding some of that joy from that moment, even today.
We're talking to Darian Dixon, the MastCamZ data management lead on the Perseverance mission. He is from Milwaukee. He's working on this key part of the Mars rover project. Now, take us a little bit on your journey, Darian, from Milwaukee to Mars.
Yeah. So, growing up as a kid, I was always super, super interested in space. I had, like, glow-in-the-dark stars all over my walls as a kid, and space posters, a telescope, just like anything you can think of. I was always really interested in space, and so that was a big dream for me. But I graduated from Riverside in 2010. I went to a small private college in Chicago called Dominican University, and actually my first year there, I majored in political science, which was also something I was interested in. But I was scared. I was honestly terrified of trying to pursue a career in space, thinking it was too hard and I wouldn't be able to handle the math and maybe I should just fall back to something that I think would be a little easier for me. I was terrified. And then for a variety of reasons, I transferred to UWM in 2011, came back home. And in fall 2011, the rover launched. And I remember sitting there at my desk watching the Curiosity rover, not the Perseverance rover,
right.
Watching the Curiosity rover launch. And I just remember that fear kind of just fading away as I watched the launch coverage, because for me it was so spectacular seeing all the engineers and the scientists working on this. And I had this realization that I was cheating myself and cheating my childhood dreams if I was just gonna chicken out and not try and be one of those people one day. And so I decided to change majors like the next day and pursue that. And you know, long story short, here I am.
Now, recently you talked online, in effect, with UW-Milwaukee students about your career. What is your message to students right now, junior high, high school, college, maybe particularly students of color who might be interested in science and technology but have that fear that you had?
Yeah, I would say never for a second, and I know it's easier said than done, never for a second let doubt creep into your mind that there are spaces or occupations or careers that aren't fit for you. Never think that, oh, this is a space where I don't necessarily belong. This is a space that for whatever reason, I shouldn't be here. This isn't for me. It's not true. Anyone can get anywhere. Anyone can open any door. So that's the biggest thing I would say is do not let that feeling creep into your mind, especially young students of color, because that's very prominent for us when we think about scientists and engineers and kind of the typical image of them, we might not necessarily picture ourselves. So don't for a moment let that doubt creep in. Don't let yourself to feel that it's okay to think that you don't belong there, because you do.
Now, I understand, Darian, a lot of people working on Perseverance are on Mars time rather than our local time zones. Is that you? What does that mean for your life?
It's stressful. So working on Mars time is in this beginning phase of the mission, where this is the most dangerous phase and things can go wrong. We want to do the bulk of our work when it's nighttime on Mars, so we can send a plan up and the rover can execute the plan and all the commands we send it during the day, and then send us that data back for us to look at it over when it's nighttime on Mars. And since Mars's day is 24 hours and 40 minutes, that 40-minute difference causes us to have to move our shift start times about 40 minutes every day. And this, there's no like cutoff where we're like, okay, we won't start work at 3 a.m. We just keep marching along. And there's times where you start work at 3 a.m. and then maybe a week and a half later, you're starting at noon. And that's just, that's how it goes. We're at a phase right now where I'm going to be logging in about 3 hours. It's wild. It's definitely a weird way to live. It's kind of like permanent jet lag, because you're moving 2/3 of a time zone every day. But I was not a big coffee drinker before this, but I definitely am now.
Well, just in our last minute, I know your mind is on Mars right now. Maybe this isn't a fair question, but what do you want to do next in your space-related career?
Right now, keep working on the MASSCAM-Z mission on Perseverance. Keep doing a great job in the role I have now. And eventually in the future, you know, I see myself moving into different leadership positions, hopefully on different missions. I think this isn't the end of my journey with space. I want to keep marching through and hopefully contributing to whatever NASA is going to be doing in the future.
Well, Darian, I'll leave it there. I'll let you get some coffee in you for that next shift. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Darian Dixon, the MASSCAM-Z data management lead for the Mars Perseverance rover mission. He talked with us today about his role on the project and his own career journey from Milwaukee to Mars. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Instagram for Kids, a social media program for children under 13, is in the works, raising, no surprise, a lot of concerns. A child psychologist joins the show, and you could join in too. The U.S. Postal Service is proposing a 10-year plan that would include cost increases and service cuts. We'll get the latest and some of the reaction from Congress. There's been an increase this year in the number of children arriving at the U.S. southern border with Mexico. An immigration expert joins us with perspective on the border issue, what has been changing over the years, and to offer some potential solutions. And eyes are on an Amazon facility in the south where employees are voting on whether or not to unionize. Big potential consequences there for workers around the country. We'll get the latest on organized labor. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. We like strange animal stories here on Central Time, and it's been a while since I shared one. So here's four, if I can get through them all in time. One, Wausau police last week were called to remove an unwelcome intruder from a local nursing home. Not a person, a young deer. The deer crashed in through a window and was wandering the halls and not happy to be there, it looked like. Good news, the deer was unharmed. Police rounded it up, released it out a door, and it bounded quickly into the woods. Two, a Toronto subway stop was shut down by a beaver on the loose. That's pretty much the whole story. It's the most Canadian story possible. Three, police in Ohio, northern Ohio, responded to a call from a resident whose kitchen had been ransacked by a raccoon. The offending animal was sleeping off his festivities in the dishwasher. The department dispatched an officer who has the unofficial title as Resident Absurd Animal Call Officer after a past incident with a kangaroo on the loose. Four, customers at a Costco in Anchorage, Alaska, say they are being routinely robbed in the parking lot by ravens. Pork ribs, steak, melon balls, you name it, it has all been carried off. One victim says they know what they're doing. It's not their first time. They're very fat, so I think they've got a whole system there. It's animal news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.